Chapter 7. The Truth About Dominance. How Social Status Relates to the Behavior of Both Humans and Dogs. Male Chesapeake Bay Retrievers tend to be big-chested, muscular dogs, the kind of dogs that love hard, pounding pets to the ribs. Bred to break the ice for duck hunters in the frigid weather of Chesapeake Bay, they are famous for being tough, independent, and just a little bit stubborn. Although I try to avoid stereotyping breeds because it can blind you to the true nature of the dog with which you're working, Chester looked like a cartoon of a classic male Chessie when he trotted into my office. He had the huge square head that goes along with a lot of testosterone in dogs and humans. Think of the jaw structure of a classically handsome man compared to that of a delicate-chinned, beautiful woman. He looked muscled up like a weightlifter, as strong as a small bull. I sat up a little straighter, breathed in, and asked what the problem was. Dominance aggression, his owner John told me, diagnosed by his veterinarian. It seemed that Chester didn't take kindly to John's corrections. When John said no to Chester inside the house, Chester would run into the bedroom, leap up on the bed, wait for John to come after him, and then, staring directly at John, lift his leg and pee on the pillow. After talking with John for several minutes, I started my usual evaluation in which I interact with the dog to see what I can learn from him. One of the things I'm looking for is whether a dog will respond to handling with a cold, hard stare directly into my eyes. A cold stare is one of the visual displays that high-status dogs will give to another as a warning. Back off, buddy, or I'll follow up on this threat. Isn't a bad English translation. You don't need a PhD to know that you could be in trouble if a dog as big as Chester goes still and looks you straight in the eye with his own eyes as hard as flint. But chilling as it is, that direct stare is a useful visual sign that helps explain why a dog is doing what he's doing. So I started working with Chester to see if I could elicit it. Few dogs, whether male or female, status-seeking or submissive, seem to like people handling their paws. How different from us they are in this. We humans like to hold hands and get hand massages and manicures. Some male dogs especially object to their back paws being handled, and there's a lot to learn about a dog by gently picking up a back paw. Some of them lick your hand, some of them freeze anxiously, the corners of their mouth pulled back in a fearful grimace. Others stiffen their bodies and glare at you with eyes like cold, hard steel. Most dogs never look at you like that, unless you're a professional trainer or have owned a particularly difficult dog, you've probably never seen it. I saw it in the eyes of a wolf-dog hybrid who took the time to shoot a look like a bullet at my eyes right before he sank his teeth into my hand. I had thrown a piece of meat 5 feet away from the bone on which he was chewing. I picked up the bone while he ate the treat on the floor and then handed him back the bone, all to teach him not to worry if someone picked up his treasures. In less than half a second, he took the bone from my hand, spat it out while he shot a furious look into my eyes, and then bit my other hand, hard and deep. Usually the look is a true warning and gives you time to act on it, within a quarter of a second or so, before you get hurt. As long as I act, the dog has no need to follow up on his threat, and there's little danger. I don't foolishly push a dog until he has no choice but to react. While I quietly handle his back paw, I watch his face out of the corner of my eye. I will also test him by reaching toward him when he has a bone in his mouth, to see if his expression changes or will gently hold on to a front paw after he tries to pull it away. In all these tests, I'm learning a lot about the dog, how he reacts to something mildly aversive, what he does when I start to take away his treasure. One of the ways that a dog can react is to go still and hard-eyed, a look that correlates with pure offensive aggression, not defensive aggression motivated by fear, not submission, and not passive helplessness. I see it from dogs who aren't willing to concede an inch, and who are signifying their willingness to back up the threat that they have just made. I see it in the few dogs that I think can be accurately described as dominant aggressive, like the wolf-dog hybrid, whose look I interpreted as, "Don't you ever do that again," and who disciplined me with a single hard bite to make his point. As I moved my hand down Chester's back leg and held up his back paw, I was prepared for him to change instantly from the big friendly lug he'd been so far to a dominant aggressive dog. Chester's eyes didn't change in the slightest, but stayed soft and liquid. He continued wagging his entire body from the shoulders back. His mouth stayed open and relaxed, his tail low and loose while he licked my face. I asked him to lie down. He did, his tail wagging so hard it moved his entire body back and forth along with it. I gently rolled him over, and he slurped his huge, silly tongue all over my hands. I let him up, gave him a bone stuffed with cheese, and then reached to take it away. He looked up and licked my hand, and then went back to his bone. I reached all the way over and took it away. He stood there, grinning, and let me do it. Chester may have been built like a professional wrestler, but he wasn't acting like a dominant dog in my office, and he didn't seem to be at home, either. John reported that he could pet Chester any time. He could groom him, pull burrs out of his tail, take away his toys and dinner bowl, and push him off the bed without a problem. Chester adored visitors. He let children play with his toys, hug him exuberantly, and sit on top of him on the floor. As a matter of fact, the only problem John had with Chester was when he said the word no. None of this was making any sense. I went back to basics and asked John again about the history of the problem. John explained that he had been warned that Chesapeakes can be stubborn, willful dogs, and that you must get dominance over them right away. The first time that Chester squatted in the house, 7 weeks old and newly arrived, John was sure to give him a good, masterful correction. "No!" he boomed, and ran to Chester, grabbed the scruff of his neck as he'd been taught by the breeder, and shook him hard. This happened several times in the next few days, John escalating the power of the no and the intensity of the scruff shake each time. No coddling for this tough hunting dog, puppy though he might be. On the second day, Chester urinated, as submissive dogs who are frightened often do, after John yelled no and reached toward him. But when Chester's ears flattened and he rolled over and urinated, John realized that his correction had gone over the top, and he immediately stopped his charge toward Chester. This same scenario, with John yelling no and running toward Chester, followed by Chester cowering and then urinating, was repeated several times over the next couple of days. You can connect the dots from here. Chester learned that if he urinated when John said no, John would stop his offensive charge. Later, Chester learned to combine urinating with a delightful tag, I'm it game that he was successfully teaching John and turned it into a romp onto the bed and a leg lift on the pillow. His look at John from the bed probably wasn't a cold threat. I'll bet that Chester was simply watching John to see what he'd do next. My own suspicion is that Chester, like lots of adolescents, loved watching his elders go crazy with frustration and had found the perfect button to set John off. Chester wasn't exactly a helpless victim here. He'd taken what he'd learned and was using it to get a rise out of John. But that's a far cry from dominance aggression. Where was the aggression, after all? Chester had never even growled at John, much less tried to hurt him. The behavior was turned around by John's changing his correction word from no to wrong. Chester learned that if he stopped what he was doing when he heard wrong, something good happened. Chester loved this new game, and last I heard, John hadn't had to change his sheets because of Chester in a long time. Dominance? Chester's behavior had little to do with dominance aggression. It was a response from a smart dog who had learned how to handle an inappropriately aggressive correction from his owner. It didn't lead to real trouble in that case because his owner was wise enough to look for help before he acted on an incorrect diagnosis and some bad advice from his buddies. But the misdiagnosis of dominance aggression and the all-too-common bad advice about getting dominance over your dog does lead to trouble, lots of it, and sometimes the results could break your heart. I will never, ever forget watching a videotape of Scooter, a big-eyed 16-week-old golden retriever puppy. One look at Scooter, golden soft, baby-headed and big-pawed, and you'd want to take him home and cuddle. Too late. Scooter's dead. He was euthanized at 4 months of age for dominance aggression, the result of horrific advice that dog trainers had given his well-meaning owners. Scooter, like most retrievers, was obsessed with objects. He adored toys the day he came home and proudly trotted around the house with anything he could get into his mouth. The responsible owners took Scooter to puppy class and asked the trainers what to do when Scooter stole socks from the laundry, the remote control from the coffee table, always a favorite of dogs, or shoes from the closet. "You must do what wolves do," the trainer said. "Go to him, grab the scruff of his neck, and get right into his face. Yell no in a loud and growly voice. You must let him know right away that you are in charge, that you're dominant, and that he can't get away with stealing things." The owners complied. I saw their attempts on the videotape. Scooter, in the first stages of this treatment, looked befuddled and scared. Holding on to a child's toy tight within his mouth, Scooter flinched when his owner, who looked just as miserable, grabbed the skin of his neck and shook him while repeating no over and over again. But Scooter didn't drop the toy. I don't think it occurred to him to do so. All Scooter knew was that his owner was attacking him. He clenched all his muscles, shut his eyes, tried to assume a posture of appeasement, and waited for her to go away. But of course, that didn't result in the toys dropping from his frozen mouth. So his owner yelled louder, her face within inches now of Scooter's, and shook him again. As the tape continues, Scooter begins to growl as his owner shakes him with her face just inches from his. And eventually he starts to growl and lunge when she comes anywhere near an object that he treasures, even if it's not in his mouth. The last scene is indeed scary, with Scooter bug-eyed and snarl-lunging at his hapless owner as she reaches within a few feet of a toy lying at his feet. But I still feel sick thinking about his death. Scooter was not a little angel. His possessiveness of objects was extreme, and I never would have trusted him in a home with little children. But I talked to the vet tech who'd been called in late in the case, and she said that the pup had never growled in any other context, adored the little boys of the family, and was a shining star in obedience class. Certainly, lots of dogs don't respond aggressively to harsh punishment and threats, but the advice given to the owners made Scooter's possessiveness much worse and eventually ended up killing him. What's so sad about this case is that dogs who are object possessive but docile in all other contexts have an extremely high rate of successful treatment, and most 3-month-old puppies can be taught to gently give you what was in their mouth. If dogs learn that they're going to get something extra wonderful when you reach toward them and their treasure, they quickly learn to trade up. After a few months of training, using positive reinforcement instead of violence, almost all dogs will drop the object in their mouth when quietly asked, whether you have a treat in your hand or not. I once rewarded a 5-month-old border collie puppy for handing me a rotting rabbit carcass by giving it back to her for a few minutes. The people watching were appalled, but she was dazzled and trusted me completely ever after. I wish that stories like those of Scooter and Chester were rare, but they're not. Just as people were taught to spare the rod and spoil the child, people have been advised for years to get dominance over their dogs, and so often getting dominance meant getting aggressive. Even the monks of Nusquit, whose book, How to Be Your Dog's Best Friend, inspired me and at least a million other people, advised owners to act like wolves and do alpha rollovers to throw dogs down onto their backs to ensure that their dogs would accept them as leaders. The book's main author, Job Michael Evans, later said that he deeply regretted this advice. Well-socialized, healthy dogs don't pin other dogs to the ground. Submissive individuals initiate that posture themselves. The posture is a display signal from one animal to another, a signal of appeasement, not the result of a wrestling maneuver. Forcing dogs into submission and screaming in their face is a great way to elicit defensive aggression. It makes sense that a dog would bite, or at least threaten to, in this context. Within their social framework, you're acting like a lunatic. Not only that, but a mature wolf would never attack a puppy that already had something in his mouth. He might growl at a puppy to warn him off an object that lay between them, but once the puppy had it in his mouth, the adult wolf would let him keep it. Mature wolves are amazingly tolerant of puppies, allowing them to steal their toys, chew on their tails, and harass them mercilessly. Besides, wolves do a lot of things that we have no reason to emulate, from eating the placenta of their newborns to killing visitors from other packs. So recommending that we humans should do something simply because wolves do it isn't exactly a compelling argument. Besides, dogs aren't behavioral replicates of wolves. That makes four reasons not to use alpha rollovers on your dog. Dogs aren't wolf replicates in the first place. Wolves don't use alpha rollovers themselves to discipline other wolves. The action elicits defensiveness and sometimes aggression, and it teaches your dog to mistrust you. The advice about using threats to get dominance over your dog is amazingly pervasive. Dog owners and trainers everywhere have picked it up, as have veterinarians, police canine trainers, and your neighbor down the street. I think it's useful to wonder about why people who would never hit their child are so quick, even against all their instincts, to follow the advice of, quote, experts, and get physical with their dog to gain dominance over her. I suspect that it's based, albeit loosely and inaccurately, on an essential truth that every human inherently understands. Social status is important to both people and dogs, and we all know it. Any human, even one with the poorest of social skills, can walk into a room full of strangers and quickly pick out the person with the most status. Others will cluster around her so that she's the center of attention. People will be more likely to bring her food and drinks, to open doors for her, and to try to get her attention. You can also look to see who touches whom. The higher someone's social status, the less likely the rest of us are to touch her without her permission. Think about how you would react to meeting royalty and how likely you'd be to run up and give him or her a hug. Remember when the Queen of England visited the States and some woman from New Jersey slapped her arms around the Queen in an all-American hug? The British were appalled, but if the Queen had wanted to, she could have initiated the hug, and no one would have mentioned it. People can gain high status in a variety of ways, but no matter how they manage to obtain it and whether it feels fair or not, individuals with a lot of social status can do things others can't. Eric Zimon, one of the world's foremost researchers of wolves, a profoundly status-conscious species, put it this way in the book Wolves of the World. The dominance relationship between two animals is expressed by the degree of social freedom each animal allows itself during an encounter. Certainly, there are still social constraints on those in power in our own and other species, but there are fewer constraints on those in power than on others. I recently saw Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura bragging on television that he broke the speed limit whenever he wanted to, driving at 145 miles an hour at one point, with no expectation of ever getting a traffic ticket. He felt secure that his social status as governor gives him freedoms that the rest of us don't have. Whether speeding, and bragging about it, is objectionable to you or not, we all understand that the governor has more social status than the rest of us. Usually it seems appropriate. I'm reminded of Animal Behavior Society conferences at which the well-established scientists can dress casually and make jokes that the graduate students would never consider making. The importance of social status is just as obvious in interactions between dogs, who remind us daily how important it is to them, like chimpanzees who use every greeting ceremony to clarify rank. Dogs employ similar postures to communicate social status each time that they meet. Watch the tails of two dogs while they are greeting each other, and you'll get an excellent idea of how each dog sees himself or herself compared to the other. Look to see who raises the base of the tail and whose tail gets lowered. The base of their tails is the relevant part, not the tip. In some pairs, the differences are extreme, with one dog's tail held high like a flag and the other dog's tail submissively tucked under her belly. In other cases, tail posture differences might be more subtle, but overall body postures contain clues too. One dog might be leaning forward more than the other, perhaps standing straighter and higher, ears forward rather than back. That's the dog with more social status. If both dogs look like mirror images of each other, with their tails high and their bodies erect and stiff, then you are well advised to distract them and get them thinking about something besides each other. Both dogs are communicating that they would like the higher social rank. Thank you very much. And it's rarely pretty when two social climbers get in each other's faces. Dogs also illustrate their attention to hierarchy by urinating in specific orders, with higher status dogs overmarking the urine of others. You can see it every night at my house. Before we climb the stairs to bed, I take the dogs out for one last pee. When we first started this routine, low on the totem pole, Pip was the first to squat, while Lassie and Tulip waited for her to finish so that they could urinate over Pip's, Lassie next, followed by Tulip. That's the order that you see among wolves, in which high-status individuals overmark the urine marks of lower-status individuals. If you have a group of dogs, especially dogs of the same sex, watch and see whether there is an order to who goes when and whether one dog overmarks the other's urine predictably. Lately, there's been a change in my dog's routine because last winter, I got tired of waiting out in the cold at 10 o'clock at night while four dogs sniffed around for the latest news about chipmunks. I started giving them treats as soon as they finished to speed them up. It works wonders. Now they tend to pay a bit less attention to who goes first and more attention to getting their treat. But I've yet to see Pip urinate over the puddle that Lassie left, and you can still bet money that Luke will wait for Lassie to go so he can urinate over it. Social status is also obvious in play, and although a lot of social differences are ignored in play, as they are in our species also, they are not irrelevant. Tulip will grab the ball away from Pip, but Pip will defer to Tulip, even if Pip could get the ball first. I've never had a dog who loved ball play as much as Pip, but Queen Tulip has more social freedom than Pip, and that means she gets the ball if she wants it. Sometimes she doesn't want it, because just like other queens, Tulip gets to say what's important when. Humans and dogs are predisposed to having hierarchical social systems because both species need ways of resolving the conflicts that inevitably arise in group living. These potential conflicts can include who goes out the door first, who gets the best sleeping place, or who gets to mate with whom. As we humans know well, one of the ways to resolve these conflicts is by fighting. But fighting is not the best solution when conflicts can come up repeatedly during the day. It takes a lot of energy and is dangerous. Individuals can avoid having to fight every time that a conflict arises with a system of social rankings in which each individual has a predetermined rank in the group. This must be a reasonably good solution to the inevitable conflicts of group living because it's ubiquitous in the world of social animals. An individual's rank can change, and in egalitarian societies is highly fluid. But each individual's position is as real, at any point in time, as his physical presence. Putting it in perspective. I have to admit that I would rather avoid this whole subject of social status, because it's become so contentious and emotionally loaded in the world of dog training, that I risk the equivalent of an electronic collar correction by broaching it. Rather than looking at the overall concept of social status, the focus in dog training has been on dominance, and to the detriment of our dogs, dominance has often been equated with aggression. They are very different things, but confusing dominance with aggression is so common that in some circles, all talk about dominance is politically incorrect. Some PhD behaviorists, veterinarian behaviorists, and trainers are opposed to even using the word dominance at all. At one professional meeting, the word became so loaded that Wayne Hunthausen, a veterinary behaviorist, and I began to jokingly call it the concept formerly referred to as dominance, complete with its own prince-like icon. I sympathize with those who object to using the word, I really do. The word has been so misused that it's tempting to drop it from our vocabulary altogether. But we can't avoid the fact that humans and dogs are derived from animals that live within a carefully organized social system. Our relationship with our dogs will profit most by our trying to understand how social systems are organized in both species, and then going on to determine how that knowledge might affect our own behavior around dogs. To get some perspective on this complex issue, it helps to look at how a variety of species relate to one another. A good place to start is with our own closest relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos. In chimpanzee society, a lot of social energy is expended on rank, primarily by the males. Chimpanzee society is male-dominated, and high-status males have more social freedom than females. Alpha male chimpanzees get access to the best food and can have sex with the females when they are most likely to conceive. High-ranking males get the most attention and the most grooming and are deferred to when they move around. They are greeted by lower-ranking members with displays of submission that we would all instantly recognize. The lower-ranking individual may hold out a hand, bow to the ground, crouch submissively with head down, or present his or her genitals. Status in male chimpanzees is particularly interesting because it is based on the formation of coalitions, in which no single male can achieve and maintain power without a cadre of supporting males. The females can also play a role in these essentially male power shifts. In his book, Chimpanzee Politics, Franz de Waal describes a newly risen male being harassed by others who had not yet fully accepted his leadership. The group turned on him. Chimpanzees have huge teeth and can hurt one another badly. And he fled to the top of a tree, where he stayed, screaming and grimacing in fear. The oldest and highest-ranking female climbed the tree, kissed him, and escorted him down, staying beside him to confer her acceptance of his position. He eventually took over the colony, but only with the backing of an active male coalition, who supported him, and further interventions from the elder female. Elder females in the colony play an extremely important role in mediating conflicts among the males. In many cases, an elder female will facilitate a reconciliation between two rival males, calming one with kisses and grooming, and then taking him by the hand to sit beside his rival, where she'll sit between them until tensions have calmed enough for her to leave, and let them interact directly. This role of females in supporting certain males and encouraging reconciliations between rival males is common to chimp societies. Sound familiar? Bonobos also focus a lot of energy on social status, but they differ from chimpanzees in two very important ways. Chimps often employ threat displays with lots of branch waving, screaming, pounding, and sometimes serious fighting as they act out their power struggles. Shakespeare would have loved chimps, but the Playboy Channel would prefer bonobos. You don't see as many nature shows on television about bonobos as you do about chimps, partly because bonobos are not considered suitable for American primetime network television. Unlike chimpanzees, bonobos resolve conflicts with sex. The all-sex, all-the-time species, bonobos have sexual intercourse with one another as freely as we shake hands, except like us, they avoid incest. They have heterosexual sex, homosexual sex, frontal sex, oral sex, and sex in exchange for an apple. And that's before breakfast. Bonobos personify the make love, not war motto, because they resolve social tension and conflicts with sex rather than threats and aggression. In lighter moments, when I'm amazed by our own species, which I am most of the time, I wonder whether we exemplify the extremes of both chimps and bonobos, quick to be aggressive if we're threatened, but obsessed with sex. Like chimps, bonobos have a strong sense of social hierarchy. But in bonobos, the primary hierarchy is among the females, not the males. This focus on social rank is not limited to primates. It's found in a vast number of species in which there is the possibility of internal competition over resources. Wasps, hyenas, even my own small flock of sheep have an obvious leader and social hierarchy. My Harriet is an old, wise ewe who could be straight out of the movie Babe, and she makes all the decisions about when and where to move the flock. Cows, too, have a hierarchy, as many a novice dairyman has learned when he tried to force the cows into the barn in the wrong order. The cows themselves decide who goes first, and a wise farmer understands the importance of social conventions among his cows and lets them well enough alone. Sheep and cows pay so much attention to who's who that herding dogs can pick out the leader of a group in a matter of seconds, even if they've never seen that group of sheep before. When an experienced border collie is running in a wide circle to get behind the sheep, she'll turn her head every few seconds to look at the flock. Border collie handlers, me included, believe that their dogs are checking on the sheep's response to their movement and looking to see which one is the leader. That's the one the dog needs to focus on when she starts stalking toward them, because that's the one with the power to decide when and where to move. Some dogs will focus on the leader so intensely that they'll walk right through the rest of the flock. My 8-year-old border collie, Lassie, will still forget herself on occasion and let the stragglers drift off as she lasers in on the lead ewe. Since this results in her bringing me one sheep instead of 30, I have to remind her that I actually need all the sheep. She stops, looks around, does what seems like a double take at the sheep behind her, and then turns back to the lead ewe. I don't know what she's thinking, but I imagine it to be something like, "Yeah, yeah, I know, but this is the important one." The important one is a concept that we humans also intuitively understand, because of our awareness, whether conscious or not, of social status. You are what you eat. Recently, there's been some confusion in the world of dog training about the role that status and hierarchy have in dog behavior. Some people argue that wolf-like pack hierarchies have no relevance to dogs, because our house dogs probably derived from scavenging village dogs who didn't live in packs like wolves. The image of historic dogs feeding on human garbage, as pigeons and rats do, may not be very romantic, but it's an excellent argument and deserves attention. These village dogs, or pariah dogs, are found on the outskirts of settlements almost all over the world. They are smaller than wolves, they weigh in at 30 or 35 pounds, are less shy of novel things than wolves, and most important to our inquiry here, don't necessarily live in tight pack formations like wolves. The limited number of observations that we have on village dogs suggests that they live either alone or in small, loosely organized groups. Wolves primarily hunt large prey like elk and deer and depend on their cohesive pack system to coordinate their hunting as a group and to eliminate constant fighting over the spoils. Each individual wolf has his or her own social status relative to all the others. Because the social relationships of scavenging village dogs appear to be different than the social structure of wolf packs, some dog trainers argue that social status and hierarchy are irrelevant to our own pet dogs. But that seems counterintuitive given what we know about how our own dogs behave and lacks an understanding of how behavior and the environment interact. Although scientists have done remarkably little research on the social structure of domestic dogs, we know a lot about the formation of social structure in wild animals, and we can use that knowledge to inform us about our own relationships with our dogs. Like many inherently social species, canids exhibit tremendous flexibility in how they structure their interactions. For instance, coyotes in Wyoming live in packs during the winter when they primarily feed on elk carcasses. At other times, when high-quality food isn't available in one handy location, the coyotes drift apart, living alone on small mammals, lizards, and berries. There's no advantage to living together when the meager food available is scattered far and wide. Similar changes in social structure occur in many species, primates included, when the distribution of food changes. Many species, called facultatively social species, split up when food is scarce but return to living in groups as soon as possible when food availability allows it. The even distribution of a low-quality food, like lizards and berries for coyotes and garbage for village dogs, usually leads to a relatively loose social structure. There is no value in looking for food as a group in a garbage dump, and there's no point in fighting over discarded bones and empty soup cans if there is similar food scattered all around the environment. But if those same individuals leave that kind of food source and start living in an environment in which food is of high quality but less evenly distributed, they'll be more successful in a group, and the group needs some social mechanism to avoid serious conflicts over the spoils. This fluid nature of sociality can explain why pet dogs behave as though a social hierarchy is important to them, even if they were derived from scavenging village dogs who might be less interested in keeping track of the social register. Scavenging dogs who live off garbage and waste are in a similar ecological niche as coyotes in summer. But take these same dogs and put them in a group living situation where the food is extra tasty and comes from only one central location, then everything changes. I've met several rescued street dogs from Northern Africa and Central America, and after hanging out in their owners' air-conditioned houses and eating organic dog chow made from chicken and lamb, they didn't act like animals incapable of understanding a hierarchy. Unlike dogs with no alternative but to scavenge on empty food cartons and human feces, our house dogs are sitting on a veritable gold mine of resources, from gourmet food to free massages every night. If that's not worth competing for, I don't know what is. A good hypothesis is that although social status is highly relevant to dogs, it's much less of an obsession with them than it is with wolves. Dogs are more like juvenile wolves than adult ones, and young wolves are less interested in social hierarchies than adults are. Eric Zimond's study of wolves in Wolves of the World showed that rank differences are most prominent among the higher-ranking wolves, less distinct among the lower ranks and younger wolves, and non-existent among pups. Although, of course, it's much more complicated in humans, there's truth to that in our species, too. Very young children aren't status conscious at all. We have to learn as we mature that some people are more equal than others. Even within the category of American house dogs, I suspect that when we finally get around to doing some good, rigorous research on their social system, we'll find different levels of importance put on status depending on how the dogs live. I see much more status-related behavior problems with dogs who live in the house compared to dogs who live in kennels or in tie-out yards. So we need to be careful when we talk about the social behavior of dogs because the same dog can act differently depending on her environment. The truth about dominance. Understanding social status is particularly important because misunderstanding what dominance means has led to appallingly abusive behavior. So much old-fashioned obedience training could be summarized as, "Do it because I told you to, and if you don't, I'll hurt you." The assumption seemed to be that dogs should do what we say because we told them to. After all, we're the humans and they're the dogs, and surely humans have more social status than dogs. If a dog didn't obey, then he was challenging his owner's social status and needed to be forcibly disciplined to be kept in his place. Regrettably, the attitude that we must get dominance over our dogs with physical force works in some cases, especially with happy-go-lucky and relatively tough-skinned dogs like some hunting breeds. Bred for stamina and a never-say-die attitude, a lot of these dogs accept gruff corrections and dominance displays with equanimity. But this approach terrorizes many dogs and leads to dogs who are afraid of their owners or who become defensively aggressive because they perceive that they are under attack all the time. Years ago, I had two women as clients who reported that their dog, a cattle dog mix, was disobedient and very dominant. When I asked why they thought she was dominant, they said, because she's very resistant to an alpha rollover. I asked them to demonstrate so that I could watch the dog. One of the women, a seemingly kind and loving person, grabbed the dog by the scruff, swung her up into the air, and slammed her down on her back. As instructed by a local trainer, she then stood over her breathless, panicked dog and growled in her face. It all happened so fast that I couldn't stop it once it started. I can only imagine what the poor little dog thought. I was stunned myself, and I hadn't had the wind knocked out of me. Luckily, the owners were thrilled to drop the alpha rollover slam dunk from their repertoire. They hated doing it, but felt compelled to do what had been advised. The hapless cattle dog is just one example of millions of dogs physically abused in the guise of training all over the world every year. Many humans equate dominance with aggression and quickly buy into using aggression to get what they want. The irony is that dominance is actually a social construct designed to decrease aggression, not to facilitate it. A hierarchical social system allows individuals to resolve conflicts without having to fight. Any individual who truly has a lot of social status has enough power that he or she doesn't need to use force. You could argue that force actually reflects the absence of real power, because if you have pure power, you don't need force. I could tell you to sit and stay in your chair, and if I had enough social status over you, my words alone would have the power to get you to comply. If I didn't have that much status-related power, I could threaten you with a gun, or worse, with having my four dogs shed all over your house for a week. In other words, if I found a way to exert enough force, I could get you to comply, but I'd only need it if I didn't have enough power in the first place. Status, dominance, and aggression are completely different things, and it does our dogs no good when we confuse them. Status is a position or rank within a society, while dominance describes a relationship among individuals, with one having more status than others in a particular context. Aggression is not a necessary component of dominance. Aggression, as defined by biologists, is an action that intends to cause harm, while dominance is a position within a hierarchy. A bloody riot in which a monarch is killed is an example of human aggression, while the fact that there was a monarch at all is an example of a social hierarchy. That monarch or president or pack leader might have been selected without violence, perhaps through family relationships with past monarchs or an election. Thus, aggression and the threat of it can be used to achieve a higher social status, but it often isn't necessary. My dog trainer friend, Beth Miller, calls my dog Luke a natural alpha. Luke is a quiet, confident dog who is secure in his place in the world and seems to feel no need to prove himself. He greets visiting dogs with friendly confidence, tail up, ears forward, clearly male dog one on the farm. Yet Luke has had plenty of opportunity to show aggression. He works dog-dog aggression cases for me on a weekly basis and has had innumerable occasions when other dogs have tried to start trouble with him. I don't put him at risk of physical injury, don't worry. But just because Luke is a dog with high social status, dominant over other dogs, doesn't mean that he is aggressive. If a dog barks and lunges at him, Luke simply turns his head away, deflecting tension, and gives the other dog no energy to bounce off of. The only behavior that Luke won't tolerate is being mounted by another male. Unless a dog is in heat, mounting is a statement about social status, not about sex. If a dog starts to mount Luke, Luke will briefly growl or occasionally growl lunge toward the other dog, making it clear that he can and will stand up for himself if challenged. Dogs accept his display of status and defer to him without incident. The concept formerly referred to as dominance. If dominance is not the same as aggression, then what is it? As first used in the study of animal behavior decades ago, the term dominance described a relationship between two animals. Dominance was defined as priority access to preferred limited resources. Nothing less, nothing more. It's about one bone on the ground, two individuals who want it, and who gets it. It's about which male gets to breed with the female chimpanzee when there are two who want to. It's priority access. I get it first. To preferred. I really want it. Limited. There's not enough to share. Resources. The best food, the best sleeping place, the best office, and so on and so forth. The aspect of dominance that's important to dog owners is the social freedom that comes with it. Some dogs will mug you relentlessly to get you to pet them, but then growl at you later when you reach to pet them in their dog bed. Dogs who are status-seeking and who see themselves as high up in the social order feel the freedom to touch you and solicit petting when they feel like it, but will warn you off for taking such social liberties yourself. In the next chapter, I'll talk about the practical implications of our status-related interactions with our dogs. But for now, it's worthwhile to focus on the ethology of social hierarchies. Sometimes people get confused about social status and dominance because it seems as though dogs are inconsistent. One dog will always get the bone first, but another will be first out the door. But dominance, or high social status, doesn't mean that one individual gets everything that he wants the second he wants it every single time. Dominant individuals don't necessarily get first access to everything. Tulip is without question the highest status dog on my farm. None of the border collies would even consider trying to take a real bone or a dead rabbit lying at her feet. But there are other things that just aren't important to Tulip, so low-ranking Pip can sleep on the couch without disturbing the social order, because although Tulip likes to sleep on it too, she doesn't care about the couch as much as she would a prize bone. Dominant individuals get to say what's important to them as part of the social freedom that they enjoy. Social status isn't always just about the most powerful individuals taking charge, for hierarchies are more complicated than that. High-status individuals are often dependent on the support of others in the group and can't maintain their position without it. The dominant male chimpanzee holds his position only if he's backed by a coalition of supporters. Despotic dominant wolves can be overthrown by a group effort of the pack. As we all know, even high-status humans can forget themselves and lose their power by overreaching their boundaries. It's also important to recognize that in animals with a social hierarchy, the group isn't composed of a dominant individual and then the rest of the group. A typical social hierarchy consists of three main categories of individuals: the alpha, or dominant, individual, a beta group of individuals who are status seekers always looking for an opportunity to improve their position, and a third omega group of individuals who are simply out of the running. In wolves, for example, the omega group always includes the puppies and young juveniles, but may also include mature adults who just aren't the type who want to be the leader. Being a leader in any animal species carries responsibilities and risk, just as it does in ours. All the evidence that we have so far suggests that individual animals of many species vary greatly in their desire to be top dog. Certainly, all dogs do not want to be dominant, although some trainers assume that they do. It's true that many dogs, much like some people, are social climbers, always looking for a step up in how they are seen by others. Most of these dogs do what they can to improve their station in life and then accept where they end up in the pack. I have met a few dogs, however, who were obsessed with achieving complete social freedom. These dogs are rare, but they are very dangerous because they are willing to pay any price to get what they want, and they couldn't care less if they hurt you or not. Other individuals, whether human or canine, just don't seem to care. Not everyone wants to carry the weight of the group on his or her shoulders. We all know people who spend a lot of energy improving their station in life, And we all know people who seem more than happy to work from 9 to 5, enjoy their garden and their kids, and let others compete over the attention and power that status confers. There's nothing right or wrong about either perspective. Societies like ours probably need that variety in order to work smoothly. If every human desperately wanted to be the chair of the committee or the president of the company, it could get pretty messy. And that general principle is just as true with dogs as it is with people. Don't be fooled, though, by dogs or people who sometimes exhibit extreme versions of submissive displays. Just because a dog is quick to signal submissive to another dog doesn't mean that he or she is not a status-seeking dog. I've seen many dogs, females especially, who give extreme versions of submissive displays in some contexts, but then as time moves on, or as the composition of the pack changes, they become the dog most likely to take over the top spot. Perhaps other dogs know perfectly well that these dogs are just biding their time, waiting for an opening, just as we often can tell social climbers, even though they posture and grovel at our feet. Sometimes the people who make the most fuss to act submissive are the most status conscious and the most interested in getting status for themselves. I had a student once at the university who all but kissed the hem of my skirt, praising every pearl of wisdom I had uttered that day. While surrounding me with submissive words of appeasement, he moved closer and closer, demanding special attention that was far beyond what other students would dream of asking. He wanted me to meet with him after each lecture and repeat the lecture to him word for word. His behavior was such an amazing combination of appeasement and assertiveness that I coined a new phrase to describe it: aggressively obsequious. And now I use it to describe dogs, too. I had a border collie bitch, Bess, who greeted new dogs to the farm in a classic high-status posture. Her entire body, from her ears to her tail, was up and forward. She'd stand tall as if stretching her body upward and trot purposefully and assertively toward the newcomers. The arriving dogs immediately signaled their acceptance that they were visiting her territory and that she had rights that they didn't. They dropped their heads and tails, leaned their bodies backward rather than forward, and let Bess sniff them wherever she wanted to. But one day, a big-boned husky cross came to visit, and this time Bess met her match. As Bess trotted purposefully forward to greet the visitor, the husky stood still and maintained her own tail-up, head-up posture. She exploded in a growl bark when Bess went to sniff under her leg. In less than a quarter of a second, Bess had flattened herself on the ground, back legs spread in what's called an inguinal presentation, forelegs cocked, head turned to the side. This time, the visitor did the sniffing, and all the rest of that weekend, Bess treated the husky like visiting royalty. They played and romped together, chased rabbits together, and slept side by side on the living room rug. But high-status Bess had instantly morphed into an obsequious groveler, constantly licking the lips of Queen Husky, bowing and scraping like the best of them. One morning, I stood shoulder to shoulder with the other dogs, watching Bess grovel. After a few minutes of this, the dogs and I exchanged glances, just as you would with human friends. I can't begin to know what was in their heads, but I still wonder whether they were as amused as I was. If you'd only seen Bess around the husky, you'd have described her as one of the most submissive dogs you'd ever seen. So remember Bess and the husky, and don't assume that all dogs who give submissive displays want to be subordinate the rest of their lives, any more than aggressively obsequious people want to stay at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Alpha wannabes. Whether an individual is status-seeking is important to know because the most aggression in social hierarchies in many species is among members of the beta group, the status-seeking individuals who have not achieved dominance but are jockeying for position. For example, dominant male wolves rarely join in when the pack's middle-ranking wolves attack the scapegoat of the group. This bullying is common in a wolf pack and is usually initiated by the beta male, who is second in rank after the alpha. Researcher Eric Zeiman reported that male wolves in the alpha position almost always showed an unusual degree of tolerance. He found that there was more than 3 times as much aggression from the beta males as from any other position in the pack. Aggression within the beta category of social status is common in many species with a social hierarchy, including humans. Any sociologist will tell you that the most tension and outright aggression in a corporation is in middle management, and primatologists who study apes and monkeys will tell you the same thing. Surely this makes intuitive sense when you think about the behavior of humans who are competing for power. Washington, D.C. isn't made up of the president and then a bunch of no-status followers. There's a large beta group of people constantly vying for power and position, and based on the news reports from our country's capital, it can get pretty toothy over there. Lots of people want to be at the top of the beta category to be the one who has the dominant individual's ear, with free access to the throne, whether it's occupied by an alpha male or the president of the United States. I call it the Kissinger phenomenon, and I see it in dogs all the time. The importance of status is also dependent on rankings of the individuals themselves. In wolves, for example, the rank differences are more pronounced among the high-status wolves and less distinct among the lower-ranking ones. In our own species, it seems that status becomes more important as an individual's social status increases. Which distinction is more important? The difference between winning the gold or the silver medal in the Olympics, or coming in 23rd or 24th in the same competition? If I won the gold and someone congratulated me on winning the silver, I'd correct her. But if the difference were between 23rd or 24th, I'm not so sure that I would. The value of the resource matters too. The same people whom I've seen graciously ignore discrepancies that lost them first place in a small herding dog trial don't hesitate to get loud if they feel they lost first place at a big, important competition. Can two species be in the same pack? Given that rank is important to both humans and dogs, how does that affect our interactions with each other? It's not completely clear whether individuals of two different species, like humans and dogs, can merge into one social unit and hold different positions in a hierarchy. This question deserves a lot more attention from scientists, as well as from dog trainers and dog lovers. One night, over cocktails, John Wright, another certified applied animal behaviorist, and I thoroughly enjoyed debating each other over whether dogs envision humans as being part of their social hierarchy. He said no, I said yes. And by the second gin and tonic, we both thought that it mattered little who was right, but that it was a great question. My own opinion is that dogs and humans can coexist within one social hierarchy because of the definitions of dominance and social status. If dominance is priority access to resources and confers more social freedom on one individual over the others, then it seems logical that individuals who live together in a house full of resources share the same problems as group living animals anywhere. If you drop a pork chop between you and your dog, you are two individuals who both want the same thing that you don't want to share. I commonly see dogs who challenge people in the family whom they probably perceive as lower ranking, small, soft-voiced, nurturing females especially, but have never once challenged more authoritative family members. Additionally, dogs greet humans with the same visual signals that they use when they greet members of their own species: heads down or up, tail stiff or wagging. Most dogs don't approach other species that way. They sniff them as objects of interest, play with them like toys, as Tulip does with lambs, or treat them like prey items. Of course, there are exceptions, but it's relatively rare for dogs to greet animals other than humans like social companions, unless they live in the house with them. Dogs behave as though they see us as a part of their social circle, and it makes sense to me that they would. Even though we're of two different species, we live together, sleep together, eat together, and have conflicts over resources. Although many of the serious cases that I see in which a dog has growled or bitten have little to do with dominance aggression, there are cases in which social status appears to be one of the factors that has led to trouble. The dog may not have been dominant, but that doesn't mean that social status was irrelevant. I suspect that a lot of the dog fights between dogs of the same household are about status, and I think that some of the bites that I see to owners are about conflicts over the social order. Dog fights within the home are most frequent and most injurious between same-sex individuals. Each sex often has its own rank order, as in wolves, sheep, horses, and many species of primates. Fights commonly occur as an adolescent moves into maturity, when status becomes relevant, and fights often occur over resources like food, space, or attention. But the perception of social rank is complicated in a household that includes humans and dogs, because even the most spoiled of dogs has to wait for his human to open the door, get out the dog food, or get the leash. I suspect that most status-seeking dogs see themselves either as being high up in the beta category or as being in a complicated and fluid negotiation with their owner for the alpha position. If you have a dog like that, the next chapter will give you some ideas about how to be a benevolent leader while your dog learns to be patient and polite. The meek and the smart shall inherit the earth. There's one more aspect of social structure that needs to be understood by those of us who live with dogs, and Pip illustrates it well. Pip is without question the lowest on the social register at the farm and the one who's most afraid of conflict. She wouldn't challenge Tulip for a bone if she were starving. But last night, as all the dogs lay around me in the living room, Pip got the chew bone away from Tulip. While Tulip lay gnawing away in the center of the room, Pip lay 10 feet away and began to grin and thump her tail while she looked at Tulip. Keeping her head low and her lips pulled back submissively, she groveled her way across the floor, slowly and relentlessly getting closer and closer to Tulip. Eventually, she ended up right beside her and began licking Tulip sloppily on the lips, her head still low, tail thumping. This kind of behavior, called active submission, is an appeasement display that inhibits aggression in polite dog society, so Tulip didn't growl at Pip. She just kept chewing on her bone and trying to ignore Pip's long, wet tongue. Pip kept it up, licking faster and faster, until Tulip finally shut her eyes and turned her head away. Tulip looked for all the world as we do when we want someone or something to just please go away. But just because Pip is submissive doesn't mean that she has no stamina. Pip kept it up, squirming and groveling and slopping her tongue all over Queen Tulip, until Tulip finally got up and walked away. Victorious, Pip then settled down to a good, relaxed chew on the bone, while I sat, jaw dropped, yet again amazed at Pip's ability to get what she wants in spite of her low rank in the hierarchy. As Pip's success makes clear, social status isn't the only way to get what you want. Stamina and appeasement work just as well sometimes. Pip's behavior is a good reminder of two important principles that all dog owners would do well to understand. First, social status is relevant in our relationship with dogs, but it's only one of many aspects of our interactions with them. With some dogs, especially the kind that aren't status-seeking, the attention that dominance has been given is out of proportion to its relevance. Second, for those dogs to whom social status is relevant, the last thing owners should be doing is using harsh, punishment-oriented training techniques. They are rarely necessary and should be considered unacceptable, just as it is no longer considered acceptable to beat wives or children. Keep in mind that there are basically three types of homes in which your dog can live. A home in which the humans use force and intimidation to get the dog to be obedient. A home in which your dog has all the social control and gets whatever he wants whenever he wants it. Or a peaceful, harmonious household in which you are a wise, benevolent leader. You get to choose. Just remember, your dog can't.